Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on Midday, conversations about countering anti-Asian racism. I'll speak with two Baltimore artists who are working to increase representation of Asian American performers, to elevate the stories of the Asian American and Pacific Islander community, and to strengthen the bonds between AAPI artists and creatives in the Black, Latinx, and immigrant communities. Corey Diacchino and Catrice Ann Tippin are co-directors and co-founders of the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective. They join me along with Dr. Carissa Chia, a developmental psychologist whose research includes work on assessing the mental health effects of anti-Asian racism on parents and children. Celebrating Asian culture and countering anti-Asian racism. That's coming up on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. It has been a week in which the Asian American community has been in the news for reasons both triumphant and sorrowful. 18-year-old Hmong American gymnast Sunisa Lee won a gold medal yesterday in Tokyo. On Tuesday, the man who murdered 8 people in Metro Atlanta spas was sentenced to 4 life terms in prison for 4 of those murders. 7 of his victims were women of Asian descent. Today on Midday, conversations about countering anti-Asian racism. As of May, the group Stop Asian American Pacific Islander Hate had reported 6,600 incidents of anti-Asian racist acts in the last year, several of which have been captured on horrifying videos. Anti-Asian incidents have spiked during the pandemic, with prominent political leaders and media personalities disparaging China in particular as a malicious actor in the pandemic. According to a Gallup poll released yesterday, just 46% of Americans are satisfied with the way Asian people are treated. That's a 14% drop from last year. Before 2016, Gallup found more than 7 in 10 Americans were satisfied with the way society treated people of Asian descent. Of course, had that poll been conducted only with Asian Americans, one can assume the numbers would be quite different. Later in the program, I'll speak with Dr. Carissa Chia, a developmental psychologist who's studying the mental health effects on Chinese Americans during the pandemic. But we begin with two artists who are co-founders of the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective, or APAC, a nonprofit organization here in Baltimore that uses art to advocate for representation of Asian Americans and Pacific Indigenous Americans and to build cross-community relationships. Catrice Ann Tippin is a photographer and a trained dancer. She's also a nurse. She joins us on Zoom from White Marsh. Catrice, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting us.
And Corey Diacchino is an actress and producer and the owner of the Diacchino Acting Studio here in Baltimore. She joins us from Baltimore on Zoom as well. Corey, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Catrice, let me start with you. Tell us about your aspirations for the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective. You and Corey started this back in 2018. How come?
So essentially, we were founded in 2018, like you said. Essentially, the idea behind it was there was such a lack of representation and misrepresentation of the Asian community in theater, and that's kind of how it started. And it was a bunch of AAPI artists that wanted to start this organization to really, you know, change that and to change that idea. And we realized, you know, as we were creating this organization, that we wanted to extend it outside of the theater. We wanted to extend it to all mediums of art. And essentially, by naming it a collective at the time, we were opening it up to different, you know, musicians, dancers, painters, so on and so forth, so that we could give every, you know, Asian American, Pacific Islander descent a voice here in the United States, and allow them to actually say what, you know, how they feel without feeling judged or misrepresented or taken a certain way. And I'm sorry. Yeah, continue.
No, that's okay. Finish your thought.
And we want to continue that. We want to continue to extend outside of the norm and eventually outside of Baltimore to really allow, to really give Asians that platform that they never really had to begin with.
And Corey, you're an actor. You've done stage work, theater work, television, etc. What's your personal experience been as a Filipina woman in the acting trade, in terms of the kinds of roles you are cast for, the kinds of roles you don't get when you audition for them, the kinds of work that is available to you as an AAPI actor?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely changed gradually over the years, especially the last few years. I think ever since, I think they called it Asian August, when Crazy Rich Asians and To All the Boys I Loved Before came out at the same time. I think there's been a lot more talk about the increase of Asian representation and how that's really important to our communities. I think for me, growing up and also at the beginning of my career, a lot of my frustration was that the focus, whenever we talked about Asian representation, it seemed to reference mostly just East Asian identity. And when you're somebody who's not East Asian and all of the stories that are being told are from a particular demographic and that's supposed to be all inclusive and extends to you, you feel incredibly excluded. And I know for me also, you know, colorism is a really big thing in our communities. I know it is in the Filipino community. And so for myself, I'm considered dark-skinned, and I can't quote-unquote pass in a lot of regards as Chinese-American or Japanese-American, East Asian. And so I think for me, I really felt that, that, you know, I might be included into this broad demographic of Asian, but I wasn't the right kind of Asian. And so that really had an impact on not just my, you know, psyche as an actor, but just my psyche as a person who grew up in immigrants in the States, to realize that you might be pigeonholed into this very, very broad and also simultaneously narrow idea of what your identity is supposed to be, and you still don't quite fit in. So, you know, I think it's gradually starting to change. I hope that the change is permanent and that it continues, but, you know, that it takes a lot of work, I think, consistent work from everyone to be able to do that. So.
Corey Diaquino is an actor and one of the co-founders of the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective, along with Catrice Ann Tippin, who is a photographer. They are both co-executive directors of the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective. It's Midday. We're talking about how to counter anti-Asian racism today. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. And Catrice, when it comes to representation, you're trained as a dancer, you work as a photographer, you're also a registered nurse, you're in the medical field as well. Talk about what some of those challenges are, what some of the, maybe give us an example or two of where you think there's a fix that needs to be implemented to raise the visibility of Asian American artists.
I think growing up, we were unfortunately told by our parents, you know, at the time, if you do as you're told, if you act a certain way, then, you know, the United States will welcome you with open arms. And very quickly we realized, you know, that's not really the case. And I think a lot of it has to do with this sense of model minority, this idea that we have to be not us. We have to act, you know, a certain way so that we can be liked more or we can have more opportunities. And I think now with these changes and with this, this sense of it's more so this realization. When we have this realization that we have a voice too, and we're done staying on the sidelines and just, you know, listening to everyone else. I think people need to understand that we have our own struggles. We can't compare to other people's struggles. We can't, and we don't want to. We want our voices to be heard. You know, we want people to listen to us, not just as someone who's Asian, but someone who is an artist of Asian descent. You know, we just from looking at us, we're already different. But that doesn't mean you can assume or you can stereotype us in a certain way. For me, I live two lives. I'm a nurse, you know, and as a Filipino, you kind of are pigeonholed into thinking that everyone's going to be in healthcare, because the idea in the Philippines is healthcare is the way out of poverty, essentially. And the idea of being an artist as a full-time job was and still kind of is a struggle, because they think it's not manageable, it's not affordable, it's not realistic. And I think being part of both sides, I'm realizing, you know, it is possible, especially now. It really is, because now our voices are actually finally being heard, and that needs to continue. We need to continue to say that, you know, that it does matter. The art that you take in, that's from us, you know, we put our blood, sweat, and tears in, and, you know, and there's a story behind it. And so.
Sure. And Corey, you're also a founding member of Unapologetically Asian, which is a group that you were part of getting off the ground. Talk about the work that group is doing and what the sort of the mandate and mission is of that, and talk about the Asian artistic community and how that has changed over the last however many years.
Yeah, well, last year, you know, I became a founding team member of Unapologetically Asian as sort of a response to the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes that was taking place throughout the U.S. and actually throughout the world as a result of COVID-19 and the pandemic as a whole. And, you know, a lot of us, I think it's pretty, for a lot of entertainers, a lot of us got put in this position of, you know, we're not deemed essential. And when you're a person from a minority group and you're already in a profession that isn't very much encouraged by a lot of people around you, whether it's your family or your peers or just the industry as a whole, because, you know, the lack of representation communicates in and of itself that your experiences aren't important. When we all got placed in this pandemic, we all sort of got into this headspace of, well, why am I doing this? I'm not essential. And the work that I am doing isn't important. Nobody wants to hear it. And so I think a lot of us sort of started to reflect on why are we doing this and what can we do with whatever platforms we've created for ourselves. And I think Diane Phelan, my friend who is the founder, the originator of the idea, one of the originators of Unapologetically Asian, you know, she always says, you know, art comes from the same place as activism. They both come from this same place. And I think a lot of us, it just became this natural motivator, this natural desire to want to take everything that we were putting in our art and put it into this form of activism. You know, we're storytellers, we're creators. In a lot of ways, art is a very strong form of activism. And I think it just became very natural for us to want to use that as a means to just share and help empower others to want to share their story unapologetically.
And Corey, when it comes to, for example, the acting business, where people are casting people partially on the way they look, partially on their age or their body type, or there's all sorts of things that go into a director's decision to cast somebody in a particular role. Are you advocating sort of equally for, race, blind, casting, which is going to put Asian American actors or Asian people of Asian descent in roles that, you know, any race, any ethnicity could do, as well as creating roles specifically for Asian American actors. I mean, is there a tension between those two things, or are they both? Are you working to see that both of those things happen at the same time?
I think it's the latter. I think for me, white is kind of the canvas that everyone wants to paint on, right? If we kind of look at that. And so I think it's the same for acting. You know, people look at white identity as sort of the canvas that you can tell any story through, to the point where white actors are playing everybody else. You know, if you historically look at the experiences of actors throughout Hollywood, you have white actors playing Latinx characters, Native American characters, Asian American actors, Black actor or Black characters. And, you know, there's this sort of understanding that white people can play anything. But the moment you see a person of color play a British role or any other role, there's this collective kind of, I don't want to say a cringe or just sort of a questioning of, I don't think that belongs, it's not right. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that we view identity and not necessarily how we tell stories. So I think for me, it's a combination. I think what I really truly advocate for is we need to encourage and empower more Asians to be the power behind the telling of these stories. We need more people behind the camera as directors, as producers, as writers, and not just as actors, because I think for me, my experience is that it can be incredibly triggering sometimes and traumatizing when you're an Asian actor in an Asian show, but there's a white person who's producing it and a white person directing it and a white person telling your story and writing it. So I think that all of those factors play into that. So I think for me, seeing our stories and being seen as human is one step, but then also showing that we are versatile and that we can play any role is another step. Actually, some of the people from Unapologetically Asian, they just did a huge virtual showing of, I literally just watched it yesterday, but it was A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. And it was an all Asian cast. It's normally a British cast, a white British cast. And it was really inspiring. And I think those are the types of things that we need to be seeing more often, is Asian actors and just people of color in general playing whatever roles that they want.
Sure. And Catrice, David Kin, who's a violinist with the San Francisco Symphony, had a big piece, or there's a piece about him in the New York Times a week or so ago, and there's also an essay by a friend of mine, a wonderful violinist named Jennifer Koh, who talks about Asian American or Asian representation in classical music. Jenny has been winning competitions since she was a teenager, you know, and she's got a international career. But she says, you know, that the heads of orchestras are not Asian Americans. The artist managers, the producers, the directors are not of Asian descent. So there's, even though there are plenty of people of Asian descent playing in orchestras and even working as soloists, the power structure is not by any means diverse enough, and it's not by any means representative enough of people in the Asian, in the AAPI community. With something like your art form, photography, I would imagine you have more sort of direct agency than an actor like Corey or a musician like Jenny, in that you can decide who to photograph. You can decide what the subjects are going to be. You can decide where you're going to display and you know, how you're going to distribute those that work. Talk about some of the other arts besides theater and film, like photography, literature, poetry, even dance, when it comes to the organizing structures around those art forms and the opportunities for Asians to, you know, to be prominent in them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think now, I think currently, especially what I've realized with the Peabody at Johns Hopkins, more and more Asian artists are stepping up to the plate. They're starting to become conductors directors, managers, because they know they are going to set the tone for the next generation of musicians that come in. I think it has to stem from this sense of hierarchy of you are the musician, you know, and you are the gifted musician, but you are going to stay in that role. And it's this sense of hierarchy that needs to be broken. This sense, you know, and the idea of orchestras was created, you know, based on a Caucasian perspective in a way, because that's how much they could, because, you know, at the time, the musicians that were early on in orchestras were all Caucasian, and that's kind of set the tone. So now with all these Asian artists coming in, these Asian musicians, dancers, they know that they need to step up and set the tone for the next generation, because that's how those structures are going to change. Because it was very Caucasian controlled. It really was.
Sure.
And so essentially. that's the way it is. And I'm very glad that all the musicians that I know now are realizing they can't just stay in one place. They really can't. You know, if they want to change the mold, they have to be the one to change that mold as well.
Yeah, and let's hope the change comes sooner rather than later. And I think the work that you guys are doing is going to help accelerate it, to be sure. Corey Diacchino and Catrice Antipin, they are co-executive directors of the Asian Pacifica Arts Collective. Thanks to you both, and break a leg on the next projects. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And coming up here on Midday, Dr. Carissa Chia. She's a developmental psychologist at UMBC. We'll talk about her research into the mental health effects of anti-Asian racism. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, my guest will be Maryland's senior senator, Ben Cardin. The senator will join me for the hour to talk about the infrastructure plan that a bipartisan group of senators has worked out and the status of bills around voting rights and other issues on President Biden's agenda. So I hope you'll join me and Senator Ben Cardin Monday here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about anti-Asian racism. We turn now to Dr. Carissa Chia. She's a developmental psychologist who studies immigrant families and their experience of discrimination and identity. Dr. Chia is a professor of psychology and an affiliate faculty member in the Asian Studies Department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's also the director of the Culture, Child, and Adolescent Development Lab at UMBC. In November of last year, Dr. Chia and several colleagues published an article in the Journal of Pediatrics about anti-Chinese racism that has been experienced by Chinese American families since the advent of the coronavirus. That research continues. Carissa Chia joins us on Zoom from her home in Ellicott City. Dr. Chia, welcome back. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So let's talk about the research that you've been conducting now for a while. There's sort of two waves of this. We talked about it a few months back, but tell us when those different waves of data collecting took place and the kinds of questions you were asking.
Sure. So the first wave of data collection occurred between March to May of 2020, and the second wave was completed in April 2021, so the earlier part of this year. And at both time points, we administered surveys to parents and youth, and we also conducted interviews with a subset of these families. And during this whole period, we've been collecting Twitter data to really situate some of these experiences on this broader landscape of public discourse around issues of COVID, but related specifically to the Asian American experience.
And what are you hearing from the people that you're talking to?
So as you mentioned, we published some data from our Wave 1 surveys. And in that publication, we really focused on the experiences of different types of racism and racial discrimination and its associations with mental health in both the adults and the youth in our sample. And what we saw was that, you know, not surprisingly, high rates of discrimination at wave one, but in contrast to wave two, and so as I said, that was completed in April, we found that, I'll just talk broadly about some differences or a contrast of wave one and wave two findings. So in the first wave, we saw that 4 in 10 adults reported being the victims of racial discrimination, either in person or online. And this number actually increased to 1 in 2 adults in wave two. And for youth, it was 4.5 youth in wave one, and that number increased to 5.5 youth in wave two out of 10.
Yeah. And we should remind folks that wave one was right at the beginning of the coronavirus, March through May, and then wave two after the coronavirus had been, you know, part of daily life for quite some time. So it did not improve. In fact, it got worse.
Correct. Right. So vicarious discrimination, so witnessing others being the target of racism or discrimination, others of your same race or ethnicity, that stayed the same across two waves, but it started off very high. So even in wave one, 8 in 10 adults and 8 in 10 youth separately reported being, you know, witnessing these acts of discrimination. So yeah, the conclusion is that things have not gotten better. If anything, they've gotten worse. When we look at even associations with mental health outcomes, we see that, you know, in wave one already, that most forms of discrimination experiences were associated with greater anxiety, greater depressive symptoms, poorer psychological health. And we saw the same in wave two, but we saw even stronger associations. And we talk about this as sort of the cumulative effects of these experiences across the year.
Dr. Carissa Chia from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She's a developmental psychologist. She studies immigrant families and the experience of discrimination and identity. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And Dr. Chia, I wonder if you'll indulge us and let us go to the phones. We have Kenzie on the line from Baltimore. Kenzie, welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to the two segments, and African-Americans and Asian-Americans seem to have the same overlapping experiences with race and discrimination in the United States. Chinatowns are a symptom of segregation of the 19th century. Why is there not more interplay between the two groups concerning mental health, civil rights legislation that that African-Americans presently have with the Latino community?
All right, that's a good question. Thank you, Kenzie. And Dr. Chia, the Black Lives Matter movement, that was happening somewhat concurrently with both of the waves of your study. Do you find any interplay or any ways in which the Asian American experience is informed by the Black Lives Matter protests for social justice?
Absolutely. I want to start off by saying that, you know, one of my take-home messages was that even though from my research, we're talking about the experiences of AAPI communities, we're not in any way saying that they're greater or more important than those of other marginalized communities. And I cannot agree more with the caller that cross-race coalitions are absolutely necessary. And I can't underscore this point enough because, and you know, one of the reasons, one of the main reasons for why there aren't even more coalitions, and there are cross-racial coalitions that are happening more and more. They have been historically as well, even the civil rights movement. But one of the reasons why there haven't been more is because, in truth, white supremacy systems work to manipulate either explicitly or implicitly minoritized groups towards what we call a zero-sum mentality. So, you know, we're made to feel as if there are limited resources and we have to fight amongst ourselves in order to access these resources. And for the Asian American community, the model minority myth that has been used and that was created during the civil rights movement as a way to make sure that, you know, Asian Americans remain silent and to in order to try to discourage coalition building with Black groups. And so, you know, I agree that at the core of addressing inequity and disparities in this country is the need to support and to address Black Lives Matter movements, demands and needs. And it's really the only way. And a lot of the work that we do is absolutely situated and led by Black leaders in our, you know, in the research that we do in our communities. And so I think that what we're saying here is that in the take home message from, you know, talking about the specific experiences of AAPI communities is that historically we've been rendered invisible and we have unique needs from other minoritized groups, as well as this shared, shared experience under institutional structural racism. And our needs are further amplified by the incredible diversity within the very, very broad AAPI umbrella that's been helpful in a way with regard to garnering, you know, power when working together, but also has been used against us in a way to continue to silence us. And so specific efforts and attention to end structural racism against any group really requires both a deep understanding of the specific needs within those groups due to their historical experiences, but, you know, as the caller said, really a broader goal of coalition building, working together towards a healthier and more productive and more equitable society for all.
And the people in your study, Dr. Chia, you talked to both parents and children. So talk about the differences, the generational differences in the understanding of the racial climate in the United States, the navigation through that, through those racial dynamics on a day-to-day basis. Are the kids doing it differently than their parents? What are the parents telling the kids? How are the parents, you know, preparing children for that navigation? And are there instances in which the children are helping the parents do the navigation as well?
Right. So a lot of it is, you know, still work in progress data that we just collected that we haven't analyzed, but and in a new study that we will be beginning in the fall that really explores these issues in more depth. But the motivation for doing this new study, and also we added in some questions about civic engagement specifically in both parents and their youth to capture exactly what you're talking about here. Because in our Wave One interviews, we heard that, you know, in times of social uncertainty and change that such as what we're experiencing right now, such as the racial reckoning led by BLM last summer, that civic engagement, participation, can be particularly visible. And so during the COVID-19 pandemic, many adults and adolescents and youth were seen to be helping their neighbors, supporting their communities in meaningful ways. But also, you know, youth of color have really taken political action to address racial injustice in response to police violence, in response to racism, xenophobia. And we saw this coming up from, you know, during the interviews that we were having with parents, and parents were talking about this, so struggling with this, trying to figure out what to do, how to talk to their children about it. But at that time, we didn't have we asked more broadly about their engagement and discussions about race and ethnicity with their children. And there was a huge really large variation in where parents were and what they were doing and how they were talking to their children about it. So we also saw separately, that's because in our sample, most families were first generation immigrants. And so, as you can imagine, we don't do a good job, you know, educating in our public school system, you know, talking about race and talking about, sort of American history from the perspective of minorities groups. And so you can imagine for immigrant families that a lot of this is new, a lot of it is, you know, difficult navigation for them to do, and their children having, you know, most of them in our sample being born in the United States have a different experience with it. And so political socialization, for instance, differ between immigrant families and families where one or both parents are born in the U.S. And children in immigrant families are more likely to have some knowledge and to be able to explain U.S. political concepts to their parents and vice versa, especially, you know, as they're adolescents and if they're themselves politically and engaged or civically engaged. And so we're really interested in this dynamics of how Asian American adolescents' participation in youth organizing groups may actually cultivate their activist group consciousness that can then challenge their parents' socialization practices. And so in some ways shaping their own experiences and socialization experiences, parenting experiences, and also in some ways shaping the way that their parents think about these issues as well.
Sure. Well, of course, the whole thing about storytelling is the story you hear depends on who's doing the telling.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's really important to always keep that in mind. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll have more with Dr. Carissa Chia. Again, she's a research psychologist at UMBC. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday. WIPR. Adam is on the line. We're going to come to Adam right after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about anti-Asian racism, a spate of horrifying videos of people of Asian descent being brutally attacked went viral this spring. The AAPI community has been blamed in some quarters for the coronavirus ever since the pandemic began. My guest is Dr. Carissa Chia, a developmental psychologist on the faculty of UMBC who studies the mental health effects of anti-Asian racism. You can join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @midday WIPR. We'd love to hear from AAPI listeners about your personal experience, the experience of your children, the experience of you and your families, about how things have gone through the entire arc of the coronavirus. And Dr. Chia, I want to ask you about these viral videos, but before we do, I want to go to the phones and give Adam a chance to be part of the conversation. Adam, welcome to Midday with Dr. Chia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Chia, my question was, I was listening to the summary of the findings for your wave one and wave two, and it was kind of shocking to me. I've seen some of the videos of the vicious attacks and whatnot, but I didn't know that the data was so intense. So I wanted to ask you, is if from evaluating the data, were you able to break down any significant findings about where this racial animus is, like regionally, geographically, and also if it breaks down through political lines? Because just from where I'm from and where I operate in the Baltimore, D.C. area, you know, we have a vibrant Asian community, and the people I work with and the people I socialize with, I don't encounter any of that. So I just want to know if you could speak to any other significant conclusions from the data on geographic lines and political lines. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that question. I want to start off by saying first that, you know, since we've collected our data, there have been also other data sets, you know, in other labs that have also looked at experiences of racism and discrimination among Asian Americans. And the numbers are shockingly consistent across groups. And so when we first saw our numbers, we, you know, we were surprised by how high these numbers were. And but since then, you know, in talking to other researchers, the numbers at different points, so they've collected also data at different points of the pandemic than we have, the numbers still show up really high. And of course, different groups focus on different types, different aspects of the discrimination. But when you just look at just any experiences during the COVID pandemic, these numbers are really consistent. So I think that's important to point out. In terms of regional difference, as you said, one, you know, would expect that in communities or in broader areas where there are larger numbers of Asian Americans, that would be a protective, you know, factor in a way. And while in some of our other research, and there is data to support this idea that certainly, you know, when during interviews, you know, a lot of, you know, families will say to us that, you know, at my workplace, I don't experience this, or, you know, youth will tell us that they know that they are living in an area or in the school, attending a school where these where they feel protected, but when they cross state lines, or, you know, when they're traveling, when they're visiting relatives, or they hear stories from relatives, that's a different experience. However, some of the, when we broke down our data, so because we, the researchers are based in Maryland, we started our data collection in this region, especially in wave one, and then we extended it. So about 60% of wave one data comes from families in the Maryland, Washington, D.C., Virginia region. And so we were able to at least look at this region versus, you know, other regions in the U.S. And what we find is that the rates aren't that different. And so also, when you look at Stop AAPI, and that's selective because it's people reporting, you see that a large proportion of the reports of these acts actually come from California and New York, where there are higher proportions. And so I think that the way that we try to think about it is that when there are there are two ways to look at it. And so while there is this protective factor, you know, social support and, you know, more resources available to communities living in regions where there are more of others who are like you, who can understand your experiences, there's also this possibility of more pushback from that, that other community if, and so there is also this opportunity for additional experiences of racism and racial discrimination because you do have a presence, right? So in areas where you don't have a lot of presence, people, you might be more invisible. And so the lack of experiences of racism may not come from, it's not, you know, because there aren't these sentiments, but because of fewer opportunities and fewer push points that bring about these acts.
It's important to remember that even though we haven't, say, in the last two or three weeks seen any more instances of these viral videos of people of Asian descent just being literally attacked out of nowhere on the street, your data is showing that the less violent, less dramatic incidences of intolerance and anti-Asian racism are still happening. You talked about the vicarious instances where people had seen others of Asian descent be discriminated against. And then in all sorts of subtle ways, the way things happen on a day-to-day basis. So what's your take on whether or not the trajectory of anti-Asian racism is evening out or has a chance of attenuating? I mean, are you at all... do you at all expect that because there are people like us on this show talking about it and that it's been a subject of consideration, perhaps more than it had been previously. Are you at all sanguine about the chances for the racial climate for Asian people improving?
That's a great question. I wish I had a crystal ball to be able to anticipate how things are going to move from here. I can say that I was at a conference presenting some of this data, and one of the other co-presenters was from the Stop AAPI Hate group, and they gave some updated data that talked about how in May, and so the last, I think, official report was published on data that ended in March, but in May there were over 8,600 reports of hate incidents compared to, you know, 6,600 in March. Mm-hmm. And so I think those data and, you know, our data and others who have, as I mentioned, collected data more recently show that it seems that the experiences of racism discrimination have not decreased. They're ongoing. And we know that what we're seeing during COVID is not, and what was unleashed, it seems, during the COVID pandemic is not something new, right? They might be, as we've talked about before, I believe, sort of opening up and making us more aware that these are underlying issues that build on historical tropes that, and a lot of the even specific acts of discrimination and words that are being said, microaggression, are the same ones that Asian Americans have been experiencing from the first, you know, wave of immigrants from Asia. And so it shouldn't be surprising to us that it's not getting any better just because people are aware of it. But being more optimistic, I think the first step is awareness. And as I mentioned before, you know, Asian Americans have been really, you know, marginalized and silenced. And it's quite cathartic right now to have some awareness and attention to the unique experiences that we have. And again, as well as the shared experiences that really underlie systems of oppression and systems of discrimination and racism that bond, you know, unfortunately in this way, but hopefully, you know, positive things, and we're seeing positive things coming out of the bonding with other minoritized groups. And so awareness is certainly, you know, the first step. And so we do see, you know, positive things coming out of this awareness, starting from, you know, President Biden's memo early on in January that, you know, really, I think, was the right move in signing the memorandum condemning and combating racism, xenophobia, and tolerance against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the United States specifically. Then that led to the House Judiciary Subcommittee hearings on March 18 on hate crimes and discrimination against Asian Americans that I think opened up a lot of opportunities for AAPI communities to share their experience, but also brought to light the racism that they were facing based on some of the responses that that they received during that hearing itself. The White House has a health equity task force that's was recently established that will try to address you know, and provide recommendations to the president more broadly about structural drivers and xenophobia and structural racism towards health that are barriers towards health equity. So there are
And as we finish up, of course, the president also signed into law the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act. That was done a couple of months ago, and that had that legislation had particular emphasis on violence against Asian Americans. So, you know, as you say, there are some signs of progress, but it is an ongoing thing that requires all of us to be vigilant about. Dr. Carissa Chia, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Dr. Carissa Chia is a professor of psychology and an affiliate faculty member in the Asian Studies Department at UMBC. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday here on Midday, I'll spend the hour with Senator Ben Cardin, We'll talk about the latest developments on Capitol Hill, including the fate of the $1 trillion in infrastructure bill, and if it passes, how Maryland might benefit. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Mallory Pinkard-Pierre is our supervising producer. Rob Civics, our senior producer. Jamila Krempel is WIPR's digital content director. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Reveal is up next after news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. I appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.